This is My Daddy Station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eagle.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
This is the voice of freedom. To the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. Listening to the Hour of the Time, I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, WRMI is experiencing difficulties. They had a direct lightning strike on their antenna, which fried a lot of components. So don't worry, it's not the new antenna. In fact, they're using the structure of the new antenna to broadcast right now. And I mean the structure, not the new antenna. It's not yet hooked up, but it will be probably within a few days, and this will probably hasten that procedure. So if you're listening on shortwave, some people say they're even getting better reception now with this jury-rigged antenna. And I don't have reports from everywhere, but north of Florida and even in the Midwest, some people say that the reception is better than normal. So I don't know. Where you're at, it could be worse than normal or even non-existent, in which case this little conversation is a moot point. But anyway, I just wanted to let you know what's going on there. The new antenna should be hooked up within the next week or two, and it's been long in coming. They've just got a few key components to complete now, and if the rain and the lightning will hold up long enough for that to be done, then we may have the new antenna online by the end of this month or the first week of August. Anyway, we're all looking forward to it. I know that many of you that listen on shortwave are looking forward to it, and it should greatly increase your reception. For those of you who want to help the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network in the Hour of the Time continue to expand its programming, call 1-800-888-9999 and order Oklahoma City Day 1. $34.95, postpaid. If you don't have that book, you've got to get it, and you've got to read it. So call 1-800-888-9999 right now and order your copy of Oklahoma City Day One. Also, you need to call Southwest International Trading at 1-800-295-2432. That's 1-800-295-2432, and ask how you can get your hands on some real money, not that funny counterfeit phony stuff in your pocket that lies to you all the time. Ask for some real money. Ask about Survival Pack number 1 and Survival Pack number 2. I don't know if number 2 is still available, but you can ask about it. And for those of you who are paying more than 10 cents a minute for your long-distance phone charges, call 520-333-4578 any weekday between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. Talk to Connie. She'll tell you how you can switch to a new service that gives you 10 cents a minute, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. And if you don't mind making all your long-distance calls between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. in the morning, we can even get it down to 9 cents a minute, ladies and gentlemen. So call Connie at 520-333-4578 and ask how you can lower your long-distance phone charges. Put more money in your pocket so that you can use it for other things. And at the same time, you'll help fund the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network and the Hour of the Time. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special guest today, and he should be on the phone right now. Is that you, David?
Yes.
David Rothman is in New York, and he is sort of a super sleuth detective type fellow, researcher, who has put together some astounding information, and by using statistics and analysis, he is going to be telling us some things that are just going to boggle your mind. So don't go away. We'll be back right after this short pause. David, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the Hour of the Time.
Thank you very much.
Your name is David Rothman. You're from New York.
Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing that has led you to some of the conclusions that you're going to be talking about here? Why don't you introduce yourself and tell our listening audience who you are, what you do, and how you got on this trail, and then we'll get right into it.
I am a writer and publisher. I have been working independently for almost 20 years as a writer and about half that time as a publisher. I started out investigating my father's life and work and premature death as an alleged CIA weapons specialist. I wrote a book about my father called Mr. Death, which was published by Playboy Press in 1982. The book does not contain any real super sleuth information, but it enabled me to start to see the weapons world, the military science world, and covert operations in a very new way. I started trying to understand patterns that might be imprinted on serious events, such as airline disasters and assassinations. Very abruptly, my life became, how would you say, a danger zone?
Nightmare.
That's a good word for it. In 1983, in August, I went to the public library, and I asked myself one question, which was, why did James Earl Ray, the convicted killer of Martin Luther King, who now claims he did not kill King, go to Lisbon, Portugal, immediately after the assassination of Dr. King? The simplest question I asked myself was, what significance did Lisbon, Portugal have? So I looked in the encyclopedia. I'm sorry, folks, this is very basic, and you will find that is the underlying foundation of all of the assassination programming that I have uncovered, tracing it to its origins in the Pentagon, the FBI, and their alleged communist allies. What I found assassination in Lisbon, Portugal, on February 1st, 1908, which was on the front page of the New York Times on February 2nd, 1908. I looked at the microfilm copies of that assassination, and I found that the king and his brother, the crown prince of Portugal, had been shot to death in a horse-drawn carriage parade in Lisbon in almost the exact same format that John F. Kennedy was shot with Governor John Connally in Dallas, Texas in 1963. The assassins used rifles hidden under cloaks. The assassins were branded, quote, anarchists, quote, immediately by the police and what was then the authorities and the existing media then. The assassins were rounded up, or alleged assassins, excuse me, were rounded up by the Lisbon police, and the alleged arch-assassin was actually assassinated in the Lisbon police jail. I think you can see easily a blueprint for the Lee Harvey Oswald assassination in the Dallas jail. You can also see a duplication from the alleged anarchist to the label of communist, which Oswald wore as a badge after being a U.S. Marine. What I thought I had found was literally a pre-existing modus operandi or program or plan or blueprint, whatever you want to call it, for the Kennedy assassination and the King assassination. It would take a little bit more time to go into the branches of the program that I claim I uncovered, which was duplicated with Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, but I do have substantial hard evidence to back up that claim. I don't want to jump ahead because it's a very large breakthrough for people to try to see the Kennedy assassinations in a very new way. And that's really what I want to introduce tonight. I don't want to go into the far reaches of the program that I claim I have uncovered. I just want to introduce the fact, first of all, that there was a pre-existing double assassination in the Western Hemisphere in the 20th century, which bears so many common elements to the assassination of President Kennedy and the wounding of Governor Connally and the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald that it cannot be ignored. That's the first statement I want to make. The second statement is almost 60 years later, James Earl Ray, the alleged killer of Martin Luther King, goes to Lisbon, Portugal, after first escaping a dragnet around Memphis, Tennessee, which closed like a noose almost instantaneously. People don't really know the setting of the King or Kennedy assassinations, but let me just state it very briefly. Martin Luther King was shot literally across the street from the police station. The first detective to actually kneel down over the wounded Dr. King was a black undercover Memphis detective named Merrill McCullough. He was there at the body at 6.02 p.m. Dr. King had been shot at 6.01 p.m. Dr. King was under constant surveillance by black and white detectives in the Memphis police and fire departments directly across the parking lot. He was under visual surveillance when he was shot. The two detectives who we know by name who were watching Dr. King when he was shot were named Richmond and Reddit, R-E-D-D-I-T-T, and Richmond as in the capital in the Confederate Virginia. Those two detectives were watching through cutout paper masks through the window of the fire station number 2 in Memphis. They were looking at Dr. King as he stood on the balcony at the exact moment he was shot. That is why Merrill McCullough was able to get to King within 1 minute. Through the next series of interviews, I will be referring to those scenes, both the Portuguese assassination and the actual setting of the King assassination, repeatedly, because I believe they are linked to the historical precedents which were set in 1908. It's a long and winding road, but the duplicated patterns are there. The impact of the two assassinations under discussion right now, actually three, Kennedy number one, Oswald and King, were literally terrorist acts against civilians worldwide believed in the ideals that those, excluding Oswald, that King and Kennedy represented. So I think we should focus on, are there duplicated patterns linked between either the two Kennedy murders, the murders of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Lee Harvey Oswald, the slow death of Jack Ruby, the fast death of Jacqueline Onassis by cancer. Jack Ruby also died of cancer. We will see many duplications through those lives and deaths if you are able to follow the trail of evidence that I am presenting. Now, I would like to drop back a second because it's a very radical point of view to take. First of all, to claim that a previous assassination may have been the foundation for a presidential assassination in the United States. To my knowledge, no one has ever made that claim.
To your knowledge.
To my knowledge.
Yes, we've made the claim here on the Hour of the Time many times that the people who orchestrate these things have repeated these events throughout history, and if you study history, you can do a very good prediction of what's going to happen in the future. But go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt, but I just wanted to make that little...
Well, that's a very important step. It's a little different from what I'm talking about, because I'm talking about within our lifetime, within our century. So I'm glad you, on your... I'm unfamiliar with a lot of the broadcasts, and I'm sorry I am. But I'm... Right, I agree with you that historical repetitions have occurred, but I am trying to gather evidence so that we can indict people today. And I'm trying to draw connections, if they exist, and if they don't exist, I'm easily challenged on them. I am trying to draw connections between the event in Lisbon in 1908, the event in Dallas in 1963, and Memphis in 1968 specifically. So by focusing on those three events specifically, I do believe we can lead ourselves on a trail which will reveal solid patterns of hard evidence that can be used to file class action lawsuits or individual lawsuits and eventually criminal charges against government officials, present and past. To get back to the original statement which I made, which was that my life changed dramatically in 1983 after I made this discovery in the library, I would like to reflect a little bit just on my personal experience for a few minutes to give the listeners a little more fuel to realize that I'm not just talking out of my ear, out of the top of my head, or any other non-relevant part. I was literally placed under fire almost immediately after I made that discovery in the library in New York in August 1983. By 1985, I was not able to work. I was not able to walk down the street or go to the library without a lot of harassment, without being sprayed with drugs, which I don't know if your listeners are aware of them, but there are hallucinogenic drugs which can be sprayed in the air, which attack a person's mental stability, even if that person is in a crowd or outdoors. And it will not affect anyone else around them if the drug has been created to attack that person's specific biochemistry. These drugs, to my knowledge, have also not been discussed publicly, but I am exposing them because I am claiming that the United States government and other governments have used them repeatedly to destabilize a lot of people, including myself. By the spring of 1985, I had written a 2,000-page book called Shakespeare versus America, in which I outlined the basic theory that the Kennedy and King assassinations were derived in part from the events in Lisbon, Portugal in 1908. I had one copy of the book, and I was preparing to take it to a literary agent in March of 1985 when my home, the home in which I was living, was at Beach 132nd Street in Rockaway Park, New York, was firebombed. I was in the home at the time. I ran out of the house when the firebomb came through the dining room windows. And from there on, from approximately 24 hours later until 3.5 years later, or almost 4 years later, I did not get out of the control of New York, 1, I was forced to confess to having set the fire. 4 men identifying themselves as FBI agents told me that they were going to kill my family in New Jersey if I did not turn myself in and claim that I set a fire in which I destroyed that book. Obviously, I'm going to defend my family, and I did. And I turned myself in on the morning of April 1, 1985, in Lower Manhattan, in New York City. And I went through the entire mental health and criminal prison system in New York State. I went through approximately 15 different prisons and 2 mental hospitals in a period of 41 months. I have been told by a former chief of police in my old hometown in New Jersey that even if I had set a fire in his town, in a house where no one was injured, that I would not have served more than a year in prison if I had no record, and I had no record. I served 41 months, even though the judge gave me a maximum of 1 to 3 years. I ended up serving 41 months, including parole. To my knowledge, I'm the only person in the United States who has gone to prison because of a book dealing with these assassinations. If there is anyone else who has gone through anything similar, I am not aware of them, and I have been writing professionally since 1977. I'm not proud of having gone to prison or having been locked up. I'm only proud of having survived it and of having documented everything that I went through and of having documented the patterns and codes that were used against me when I was locked up. I'm also proud of the fact that I wrote about 10 books in the 3 years that I was in prison, books which I am preparing to publish now after almost 10 years after having gotten out of prison. The point I'm trying to make is that if I had not discovered something important, why did my life almost become my death? Why did I go to prison? Why was my house firebombed? Why did all of those things happen? No one has ever answered those questions.
Well, I think the answer is obvious, David. Many of the same things have happened to me and to other people who are engaged in trying to expose the corruption and treason and terrible things that have been happening and are perpetrated by people within the government. I don't believe and never have believed that the government is actively involved in these things, because the government is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the amendments thereto. It's people in government who have agendas and political allegiances that amount to treason are just out-and-out criminals who are involved in these things. And, of course, since they occupy positions in government, then we tend to look at it and say it's the government, when actually it's these people who belong to organizations and political movements and communist parties and many other things that are actually bringing these things about. And anyone who shines the light upon these cockroaches and causes them to scatter back into the darkness under the refrigerator is subject to their terrible wrath. I've been subject to it. Many other people have been subject to it. There are patriots today who are in prison, who are there because they've been framed, or some terrible things have happened, and I've exposed some of them on this broadcast, and others have been exposed elsewhere. But that's why these things have happened to you, and they may continue to happen to you. And you're not the only one, but it happens to anyone who has the guts to stand up and tell the truth.
I agree with you. It doesn't happen to me much anymore because I'm always armed, and they know that I am able and willing to fight any time, and they have backed off a considerable distance, not only because of my willingness to fight, but also because they know that I have documented everything I have just said on this interview, and that a lot of it is on my website now, and that I'm preparing to publish a lot of information about it. So it does not happen to me anymore. It has stopped, I would say, within the last couple of years.
Well, good for you. That's what keeps most of us safe, is the fact that we're in the public eye. We have documented what we say. We have made that document, those documents, or that documentation, I should say, available to the public. and have put certain documents in the hands of trusted people, and so they don't want to create political martyrs at that point.
Because no, I'm not in that business either.
Yeah, then it verifies what you're doing, and could, and this is the dangerous thing for them, it could cause a tremendous political movement to rise up around a fallen martyr, much like happened in South Africa with Nelson Mandela. I'm sure that they rue the day they ever put that man in prison.
Yes, I would like a movement to arise. It doesn't have to arise around me, you know. I'd like to be around with it.
Yeah, nobody wants to be a martyr. I'm not saying that. But
I'd like to urge everyone that the real key to beating the tar out of these agents who persecute people is basically to document everything that has happened. Either put it on tape or write it down. And it really does have an effect. And if anyone wants to send me anything, we can make arrangements for people to get in touch with me. Because I'm not afraid of fighting the FBI, the Pentagon, or any of the other individuals that I will be naming and have already named. I would like to reflect a little bit on a confrontation I had with one federal agent while I was in prison, if I may.
Sure, go ahead.
It will shed quite a bit of light, I believe, on my allegations. On March 34th, 1987...
Oh, wait, March what?
24th.
24, you said 34. Okay.
If I said 34th, I meant March 24th, 1987, in Mid-State Correctional Facility in Utica, New York, in the afternoon at approximately 3 o'clock, I was sitting in a classroom where I was being taught janitorial skills by a gentleman named Richard Ambruso, who was a prison teacher. I was surrounded by hardened convicts sitting there listening about how to wax floors and clean toilets. When a young black man knocked on the front door of the classroom with a note saying that I had a visitor in the legal counseling room in the prison. In my entire 3 years in prison, I had no visitors. I had almost no mail. I never had any phone calls. Nobody wanted to be in touch with me. Nobody wanted to know me. So I figured it was some kind of setup. I got up out of the class. I went to the legal counseling room, and a Secret Service agent was in the room, and his last name was Ryan, R-Y-A-N. I do not know his first name. In the room was also a prison psychologist whom I had befriended, whose name was Dr. Thomas Carlton, C-A-R-L-T-O-N. I do intend to call Dr. Carlton as a witness eventually. The Secret Service agent was at the prison to interview me because he claimed I had written threatening letters against, quote, their protectees, quote. I was outraged at the charge. I didn't even sit down. I stood in the doorway of the room.
David, let me interrupt. What is a protectee? We have to remember that there are many people out there who don't know some of these terms.
I believe it is their language for people that are under the protection of the United States Secret Service.
Sort of like a witness protection program?
No, it's not secret like that. It would be the president, vice president, high government officials.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, see, I didn't even understand what you were talking about. Okay, go ahead.
That I had written these letters. I stood in the doorway and I said, and I started getting mad, and I said, several times, I just challenged him. I said, do you mean to tell me you came all the way up to upstate New York to accuse me of writing threatening letters, and you don't have a copy of any letters? Because I'm a writer, and I remember, you know, what I have written. I have cataloged letters that I have sent from the prison. I had sent my family a series of letters approximately 10 days earlier, and I have this in my legal record, the exact dates that I sent the letters out, and I have copies of all the letters I sent to my family in February and March of 1987. There are no threats at all in any of those letters. Agent Ryan said, I only have a computer printout of the letter. I said, well, can I see it? He opened a folder and he quickly closed it and he said, no. I said, I came close to using profanity. And I said, again, that I believe it is extremely unprofessional of you to make these accusations against me, especially in a prison. It's my safety if I'm in a jail, because they're going to think I'm a snitch.
Sure.
And I never was. I have never betrayed anyone, even when I was threatened. I have never betrayed anyone. And it basically proceeded along some very bizarre lines. Agent Ryan claimed that he had no knowledge of my writings. I said, I am writing a book now about the assassination of President Kennedy, which was a book I had already written several years ago that had been destroyed. He offered me an unlimited amount of money for the first 75 pages of that manuscript, and I refused. Dr. Carlton.
Who offered you this money, this federal agent?
Secret Service Agent Ryan.
Okay.
He offered me an unlimited amount of money. And obviously in a jail, when I'm not getting visits, I'm not getting mail, I'm not getting phone calls, and I'm only making 20 cents a day, I need money to buy food and everything else in a jail.
Sure.
And I refused. I was really offended at this point because I knew it was nothing less than a really cheap setup. So I tried to keep my politeness, and I stayed professional. I did not curse at him. I did not yell. I did nothing like that. But I was defiant, politely defiant. He asked me, what are you going to do when you get out? This was March 24th, 1987. I did not get out until January 6th, 1988. So I had how many months? 10 months to go. I had no idea what specifically I was going to do, but all I wanted to do was get a job and start my writing career again, and that's what I told him. He said, are you going back to Rockaway, which is where the fire had occurred? I said, no. I'm going to someplace in New York City where I can get a job and live a quiet life and do my writing. And he made the most heinous remark about the people of Rockaway, New York, or people of the United States, that I have ever heard from anyone, let alone a bum, a terrorist, or a government official. He said something about the fire, and then he said, out of the blue, and this is a direct quotation, he said, a lot of those houses deserve to be torched. End of quote.
Huh.
That is an exact quotation from a U.S. Secret Service agent to me, in the presence of Dr. Thomas Carlton in the legal counseling room at Mid-State Correctional Facility on March 24th, 1987, at approximately 4 p.m. in the afternoon.
Is there a movement of people or somebody that they don't like that particularly congregates in Rockaway, New York?
Retired white people. That's all who lives in Rockaway.
Huh.
There's no radical movement. There's no headquarters for anything there.
Yeah.
There's a beach. There are quiet suburban streets. Small one- and two-story homes. It looks like Ohio. It looks like Kentucky. It's a very quiet residential neighborhood. There's no industry. It's off to the left of Kennedy Airport. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's literally nothing of significance there. But that is exactly what Agent Ryan said to me. A lot of those houses deserve to be torched. I never forgave him, and I never will. And I intend to eventually press charges. I am attempting to collect evidence that the Secret Service was involved in both Kennedy made against anyone in the United States, and it was literally targeted against everyone in the United States. Because I was attempting to represent the people of the United States, as badly as I did it 10 years ago, I was attempting to get the truth about the assassinations. And in my first major contact with a federal agent while in prison, that was the response I got, along with the fake letter charge, the lack of evidence, and the very arrogant attitude, and the lack of ability to accept me either as an equal or as someone with any amount of rights. I didn't have a prison record for rape, murder, terrorism, theft, anything. The only charge ever placed against me was for that fire, and no one was injured in the fire, and it was small damage. And he was talking to me probably worse than anyone has talked to Charles Manson.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I imagine some people have said some pretty bad things to Charles Manson.
Sure, but do you think the Secret Service said to Manson, when you get out of jail, where are you going to go? Are you going to set a fire? And by the way, most of the houses in Brentwood deserve to be torched.
I don't know if they did or not, but I don't think he's ever going to get out of prison. But, you know, David, there are a lot of people out there listening to this that are shaking their head, probably saying this guy is nuts off his rocker. And I just want to say that some of the things that have happened to you have happened to me, and you're not nuts, you're not off your rocker. There was a time when the Secret Service came to, or at least people representing themselves as Secret Service, came to St. John's when I had a research center there, that's St. John's, Arizona. And I was there every day, and they knew exactly where my research center was. But instead, they went around to the businesses in the town telling them that I had threatened Jimmy Carter's wife, who was coming to Phoenix for some speech or something, and that they couldn't find me, and they were asking people where I was so that they could talk to me. Well, they knew exactly where I was, and I was in the research center every single day, and everybody they talked to in town told them that, but they never came to talk to me. They never said a word to me. And the whole thing was to demonize me in the eyes of the citizens of St. John, Arizona, that I was some kind of a wacky kook that was out to kill an ex-president's wife. That I would never threaten the president, much less the president's wife, but to go after the president's wife, who wasn't even president, is just absolutely insane to begin with. But anyway, that's the kind of things that these people do all the time. And there's nothing unusual or weird about it whatsoever. I just wanted to clear that up.
But sure, if I may interject another comment based on what you just said. And two agents claiming to be from the FBI did exactly the same thing to me in Brooklyn Heights, New York, after I got out of jail.
Uh-huh.
Did the same thing that you're talking about, only this time, they changed the channel, and they said they wanted to talk to me about my visit to the Russian consulate.
They're trying to make a spy out of you now.
I don't really know what they had in mind.
But they didn't come and talk to you.
No, I was working across the street. It's a tiny little street called Montague Street,
sure,
in Brooklyn Heights, New York.
Yeah.
Just like you, everybody knew me on the street.
Yeah, it's the same thing they did to me. They were trying to demonize you to your neighbors so that they would shun you, and you would be socially unacceptable in your own place of employment or work or business or where you live. It's a standard tactic that these scum-sucking, puke-faced, Nazi, jack-booted thugs use all the time.
Well,
and by the way, that's exactly what they are.
I use the same words. I had to change jobs 25 times and move 25 times in a five-year period in New York City after I got out of jail in 1988. Within 5 years. From 1988 to 1992, I moved my apartment 25 times and I changed jobs 25 times. I'm just providing this information. If people want to shake their heads and say that I'm crazy.
Well, some always will. So don't worry about them. Just tell your story.
Okay, I'm just trying to provide information to say that if I had not discovered something, why did those things happen?
Sure.
Why did people who are on a payroll of the federal government come to a prison hundreds of miles away from where they work to make a charge against me? And then why did agents from another branch of the federal government come to my place of employment a couple years later and, in a more polite way, do the same thing? if I had not found something.
Sure. And if you had really done those things, why weren't there any follow-up charges or trials or you know?
No charges were ever filed. I have never been charged with any federal crime whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, every federal agent has supervisors. They all have an agenda. They have a schedule. They have quotas. They have every kind of format that every other person in a position of authority has to answer to.
Yes, they do.
Of course. So if somebody came to talk to me 500 miles from his office, it means, and they went to my family in New Jersey first, it means that they were going back to their supervisor to answer what they found. Now, that cannot happen out of thin air. If I am just a lone lunatic, if I am crazy, that can't happen. Because they would have dealt with it through the psychiatrist who was in the room. He's a fully authorized psychologist. There were never any psychological charges pressed against me. I passed every test. I had been analyzed by a dozen psychiatrists and psychologists by 1987, from 1985 to 1987. And Dr. Carlson was in the room during the entire interview. And not once did he make an objection. Not once did he tell me to calm down because I didn't get excited. I represented my own rights and the rights of citizens.
Well, I would have got excited, and I would have told the guy to either produce some evidence or, you know, get the blankety-blank out of my...
say that, but I said it in a milder way.
Yeah, well, you're a little bit more polite than me. I stopped being polite a long time ago to these people.
Well, on the street, I'm not polite. I'm willing to fight to the death on the street, but I was locked in a jail.
Yeah.
I was surrounded by convicts that I could not trust, plus an authority system I could not trust.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to restrain myself pretty severely. The point I'm trying to make is to the people who have never experienced this kind of anti-civilian terrorism is that it doesn't happen unless you have done something that hits the mark.
No, they don't waste their time against anyone who does not present a real threat to them or their organization or their agenda.
I was not a physical threat in any way. I have no movement. I had no associates. I had no family. Almost no friends. I was alone. And for them to spend the taxpayers' money to go through those maneuvers, and they happened a lot more after that. I've left out a lot. The point is, they spent a lot of people's money tracking me down and doing what they did to you. And they have never been held accountable for that.
Yeah.
No one ever goes to them from the General Accounting Office saying, how much money have you spent from the taxpayers to track down alleged...
to harass David Rothman.
Right. And anybody else that is on their list.
Yeah.
There is no oversight, no overview, no supervision, no accounting, and it's your money. Everybody who's listening, I don't care what you think of me, it's your dollars. And I really... it matters not whether you ever read a book of mine. The point is, this is an enormous machinery that has wasted literally trillions of dollars.
Well, David, you know, you're talking to an awful lot of people who watched what happened in Waco, Texas, and don't think anything of it. They don't even know that it's not against the law to own a machine gun, and that the only thing in question there was if David Koresh actually did own a machine gun, which the evidence shows that he did not, was a $200 tax. And for a $200 tax, they killed almost 100 people, murdered, as a matter of fact, burned, bulldozed, and destroyed all of the evidence of their crimes. They spent 51 days using millions and millions of dollars and hundreds of federal agents because of their alleged inability to collect a $200 tax for the ownership of an alleged machine gun, which existence has always been in question. And the only one that they were after was David Koresh. Why did they persecute, hound, and destroy all of those other people? So when you're talking to people who don't even understand that that was a terrible thing and just shrug it off like rainwater, then really what you've got to do is ignore the detractors and the people who would say something about your, you know, what happened to you, and just concentrate on telling the people who really want to know, because there's a lot of them out there, I can assure you.
I'm not necessarily... detractors. I mentioned detractors, but I think it's fair for me to try to establish some kind of credentials.
Sure.
Even for people who want to know what I claim I know.
Well, that's really what this first broadcast is all about, because, folks, he's going to be with us probably all week or until we really cover the material that he's got for us, and it's quite a bit, I got to tell you. We're going to give you his website address so that in between programs or while you're listening, you can go to his website and sort of follow along and see what we're talking about. Do you want to give that or do you want me to give it?
Sure, I can.
Okay.
www.ally.com/crime. I'll repeat it once. Sure. www.ally.com/crime.
And there's a lot of documentation of some of the things that you're going to be discussing on that website.
Yes, there is. I have produced almost 1,000 audio tapes and approximately 100 books documenting what I claim are federal and communist assassination codes and programs used not only in the Kennedy and King assassinations, but used in child murders, bombings, airplane disasters, and just about every other anti-civilian terrorist act that has occurred. I have researched serial killers and traced the same U.S. government codes and programs into their crimes. I have analyzed the JonBenet Ramsey murder, the World Trade Center bombing, the Oklahoma City bombing, the Ted Bundy murders, the Charles Manson cult, the Son of Sam killings, and many others. And
well, Son of Sam was pretty obvious, don't you think?
No, because there are patterns within the crimes themselves that have not been published or analyzed or even talked about.
Yeah, but he more or less admitted that he was working for a larger conspiracy, and that he alluded to the fact that Son of Sam meant Son of Uncle Sam, a creation of Uncle Sam, and all kinds of other things. I mean, that he was...
Berkowitz ever personally claimed that he was working for the United States government.
Pardon?
I do not think that David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam...
No, he alluded to it. He's never admitted anything. In an interview that I read, he was sort of joking, but he alluded to the fact that Son of Sam was really referring to a creation of Uncle Sam.
All right. Well, I have hard evidence to prove it.
Well, that's fantastic.
I've analyzed most of the victims, their name patterns, just very briefly. I'll give you the improbability of the Son of Sam case in a nutshell. 13 victims. Shot over a 13-month period between midnight and, let's say, 3 a.m. in a city that has a population base of 15 million. Supposedly, all the attacks occurred at random. Supposedly, he was taking orders from a German Shepherd dog named Harvey. And supposedly, he just got in his car and drove around New York City looking for lovers on lovers' lanes to shoot. Now, if anyone did that, according to that pattern, according to that program, there would be almost no patterns visible in the victims, because they would all be random.
Sure.
The population base is huge, the geography is huge, and it's a large time frame, 13 months. But the exact opposite occurred. 7 of the 13 victims were Italian, and that's an extraordinary percentage, that's over 50%, in a city where the Italians are a very small minority. I don't know the exact figures, but I'm sure there are fewer than 10% of Italians in that 15 million population base. So right away, the percentage of victims and their ethnic identity is way off considering the demographics. Number two, the victims' names duplicated in several times. One of them was named Jody Valenti, a young woman. Another was named Valentina Voskarichian, and another one was named Robert Violanti. Not only does the letter V repeat 3 times out of 13, but the name Valenti and Violanti and Valentina all have the same derivative of Valentine. in terms of a 15 million person target range, working after midnight, taking orders from a dog, in a high state of psychosis. It is literally impossible for the Son of Sam killers to have found those three people at random. It's just impossible. And that's only one small improbability in the Son of Sam case.
How many did you find, all total?
13 known victims, but there are probably more. But the names of the victims that I've been able to track were 13. There are even other patterns within the set of patterns that are bizarre. The last fatal victim was Stacy Moskowitz, a 20-year-old Jewish girl from Brooklyn. Her boyfriend, Robert Violante, survived, but he was blinded. Stacy Moskowitz had a sister that nobody, it's not discussed in the case. Her name was Jody Moskowitz. Jody Moskowitz only lived to be 10 years old. She died in 1968, so she was born in 1958. Stacy Moskowitz and Jody Moskowitz were buried side by side in a Jewish cemetery in Clifton, New Jersey. The point I'm trying to make is that Stacy Moskowitz was sitting in a car with a boyfriend named Robert Violante, whose name matches another Son of Sam victim completely different from another part of New York, named Jody Valenti. And Stacy Moskowitz had a sister who died at the age of 10 named Jody, J-O-D-Y. J-O-D-Y is not a common name in New York City. I've personally never known anyone by that name. I've only heard of one person by that name aside from Jody Valenti. Mm-hmm. And then when I found out about Jody Moskowitz, that was the other one. But I personally have never been involved with anyone named Jody, and I have lived in New York for 25 years. And I'll bet that most of the people I know may have known one or two people by that name, but it's not a common name.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, how could it have happened by terms of probability? The answer is, combined with the other statistics, 7 out of 13 victims being Italian, and the Jody duplication, the Valentina, Violante, and Valenti duplications, the letter V duplication, the 13-month duplication, and the 13 victims duplicated, and many other patterns within the collected victims add up to a profile that is extremely unrealistic in terms of crime in New York City. And that is what I would present as an indictment, starting with several police departments in New York City and New York State, and then going up to the federal level, because I do believe there is evidence of federal involvement. It would take a longer time to get into that. But the point is, by looking at the victims and the patterns of where they were shot, how they were shot, who they were related to, where they are buried, what Berkowitz has said and done, what is known about him specifically, what evolves is a very bizarre computerized program of serial murder. Bit of information about Son of Sam is that he was born Italian. His original name was Richard Falcone, F-A-L-C-O-N-E.
Mm-hmm.
He was adopted as a teenager by the Jewish family named Berkowitz, but that's not his birth name.
Mm-hmm. Nor was he Jewish by birth.
He was not Jewish by birth.
Right.
He was Italian by birth.
Yes.
Which, compared to the bizarre statistic of 7 out of 13 victims being Italian, in a supposedly random series of attacks, adds up to a very large question mark. It is literally impossible to have occurred within these demographics.
Well, you realize that there is some tremendous occult significance with some of these letters and names, and especially with the number 13, to the organizations that are doing a lot of other things to destroy.
Verkail is a word in a satanic program.
Yeah.
Verkail. There is a lot in the Son of Sam case that is going to be revealed that is very, very ugly. There is an extraordinary amount of evidence that Berkowitz was under police surveillance constantly and that they let the attacks occur. A police officer lived in the apartment underneath Berkowitz's apartment in Yonkers, New York, at 35 Pine Street. The officer's name was Craig Glassman, bunch of trash in front of the door of Craig Glassman's apartment and set it on fire. And Berkowitz was never, ever brought down to Yonkers police to answer for a charge of arson. He also set fire to a trash can outside the apartment building at 35 Pine Street, and also was never charged with arson, not even reckless endangerment.
But they knew that he did both of these things at the time that he did them. Is that correct?
Excuse me?
They knew that he was the one who did both of these, who started both of these fires at the time that they were started?
Craig Glassman knew, and Craig Glassman was a Yonkers police officer. In addition, the two brothers who were associates of David Berkowitz, who were named John and Michael Carr, C-A-R-R, whose father owned Harvey the German Shepherd that was supposedly giving Berkowitz orders, were known members of a satanic cult in Yonkers. Aside from that, their sister, whose first name is Wheat, W-H-E-A-T, was the dispatcher for the Yonkers Police Department in 1976 and 1977. So, right there, there are two major connections to a police department. They had to have known that this psycho was setting fires in his own apartment building and outside it. Craig Glassman knew. And Glassman worked for the department that Wheat Carr worked for. And Wheat Carr was the sister of two brothers who were close associates of Berkowitz. So why did Craig Glassman never go to arrest David Berkowitz? Why
question.
Did Wheat Carr never file a charge? Well, obviously her brothers were close to Berkowitz.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to satanic murder, you got to be crazy to be quiet about that. Aside from the fact that everybody in Yonkers had to have known, it's a small town. It's a small city. There were dead German Shepherd dogs turning up in Untermeyer Park. There was satanic cult activity in Yonkers, New York at that time.
Or what somebody wanted people to think was satanic activity.
Better said by you. Yes, that's a better way to say it. But later evidence that has come forth, I believe, substantiates the claim that Berkowitz was involved with a satanic cult, but that the cult itself was programmed using federal computer codes. That's my allegation. Because I've traced the same cult codes to the Charles Manson cult, to Ted Bundy, and to other serial killers, as well as the assassinations that we have started to discuss.
Well, David, let's hold everything off until tomorrow because we're out of time.
Okay.
So we'll do this again tomorrow, and we'll be talking about all of these things. I find it extremely interesting. People who have not studied the symbology and the occult history and rituals of the secret societies and some of the more dangerous cults and organizations around the world may not understand what we're talking about, but I certainly understand it, and many of the listeners to this broadcast do, because we've covered these subjects many, many, many hours over the years. So I want to thank you for being a guest today. We look forward to seeing you again tomorrow. And folks, good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. And the circus goes on.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
This is the Voice of Freedom.
listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. If you'd like to help the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network continue to expand its programming, call Southwest International Trading at 1-800-295-2432. That's 1-800-295-2432. Ask how you can get your hands on some real money. Various forms, but we recommend coin and we recommend bullion coin. We do not recommend numismatic investment grade coins unless that's something that you're into, and you got to know something about it before you make those kinds of investments. But if you, whatever your interest is, call Southwest International Trading at 1-800-295-295.